This is Radio Superior 1928, a reproduction of actual news events with authentic popular music from the roaring 20s. This is a true story of our past, so step back with us to another time. We bring you now inside the KUWS radio studios and the Martin and McKenna Show.
Hello, hello. This is the voice from the Head of the Lake Station, KUWS, calling from Superior, Wisconsin. Jack McKenna speaking. It's Monday, June 18th, 1928. Lou Martin has the 5 o'clock news report and the latest about President Coolidge. Harriet is in with the Mutt report.
As in mutton?
Nothing about mutton.
Which makes me a glutton.
Isn't that something? And we've got the best music in town, or at least on the block.
I heard an ugly rumor that our new engineer is engaging in some kind of a flagpole sitting stunt, too.
High places give me the willies. The 5 o'clock news is brought to you by Piggly Wiggly, where they have firm, ripe bananas for a nickel a pound and bunches of radishes for a penny. Good afternoon, Lou.
Good afternoon, Jack, and good listeners. It appears presidential nominee Herbert Hoover is coming to Superior, and President Coolidge is stuck at the Pierce Estate on the Brule for the time being. We begin a series of reports from our wire correspondents and Evening Telegram reporters. First, from Washington.
This is Washington. Brisbane here. Refreshed by the rest of the Sabbath, Herbert Hoover enters upon a week anticipated as replete with political activity. Sometime this week, it is expected that he will reach decisions on numerous points of importance in connection with his campaign as Republican nominee for president. Mr. Hoover today faced the necessity of early decisions as to when he will resign from his position as Commerce Secretary and visit President Coolidge at the summer White House in Superior, Wisconsin. Also, the receipt of official notification of his nomination and various details of his campaign organization. This is Arthur Brisbane in the nation's capital.
This is Evening Telegram reporter Clough Gates. While bad roads separated President Coolidge from his summer executive offices today, the first of the visiting notables expected here during the 10 weeks arrived in the person of William M. Butler, chairman of the National Republican Committee. His arrival from Kansas City followed close on the heels of Presidential Secretary Everett Sanders and former United States Senator Irvin Lenroot, who arrived Saturday. With everything in readiness at Central High School, it appears that the president will spend still another day at the Brule before coming to Superior. Reports that he had gone fishing could not be verified, although it was learned that members of his staff at the summer White House were out trying their luck at an early hour. Mr. Butler arrived here this morning from Kansas City to drop in on President Coolidge on his way home. After breakfasting at the Androy Hotel and conferring with the president's personal secretary, Edward Clark, he left with Mr. Clark for Cedar Island Lodge in an Army automobile. President Coolidge would in all probability remain at Cedar Island all day today. The wet weather and the condition of the roads, which were damaged Sunday by the heavy traffic, were factors in keeping the president from his Superior offices. It was intimated that a sore right heel, which bothered him on his trip, may have influenced him. President Coolidge wired a message of congratulations Saturday afternoon to Senator Charles Curtis on his nomination as Republican candidate for the vice presidency.
This is Axel Berquist. The majority of the presidential party, moving picture men and press representatives are stopping at the Androy Hotel for the duration of President Coolidge's vacation here. A few of the members of the presidential party have been placed in private homes by the Housing Committee, while others have taken suites at the Nottingham Apartments. The Androy Hotel management has taken 5 suites at the Nottingham to accommodate visitors who desire larger apartments than the hotel affords. This is according to Andrew Doran, the hotel manager. Full hotel service, however, is given them, he stated. In each apartment, a telephone has been installed connected directly with the telephone exchange at the Androy Hotel. four Army Air Mail flyers, a party of American and telephone and telegraph men, and several moving picture and newspaper men are located at the Nottingham Apartments. It includes George Durno, International News Service, G.M. Dorsey, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer News, J.M. Lilliff, Fox News, Robert Denton, Paramount News, and Thomas J. Howard, P&A Photos. Suites 601 to 603 at the Androy are occupied by Mr. and Mrs. Everett Sanders, secretary to the president, as well as his wife. Room 602 has been furnished with office equipment for Mr. Sanders, a large mahogany desk, several chairs, a private telephone line, and a house phone are installed in the room. This is Axel Berquist.
Your reporter Paul Scamser here. Well, there was little traffic on the road Sunday morning when President Coolidge attended Brule Congregational Church. During the afternoon, the highways from Superior to Brule were a constant stream of cars. Most of them had Wisconsin licenses, but many were from outside the state. Some were California. Traffic tie-ups were common. Steady rain pouring down all along the route did not seem to dampen the spirits of the tourists who were presumably out to see the Brule and Cedar Island Lodge if they could. Henry Denny, store proprietor of Brule, says the rain killed the morning's business in gasoline and edibles. There were, however, he told the visitors, 40,000 cars marshaling in Iowa for the drive on the Brule due to start next week. Many more were gathering for the onslaught from the western states, he declared, and the east was preparing for a tourist invasion such as the Brule has never seen. Highway number 2 was badly washed by the rain, most of the gravel which was dumped on it last week having already disappeared and rough spots appearing in places. County Highway B was in excellent condition, its sandy surface being well packed by the heavy rains presented a smooth, even surface to the afternoon motorists.
This is J.B. Somerville reporting. President Calvin Coolidge listened to plain John Taylor, a blind lay preacher, Sunday, in the little Brule Church, telling his hearers of the need of the gospel. Outside, heavy skies poured intermittent rain on the dreary country landscape. Within the church, 150 worshipers listened with rapt attention to words interpreted from the Bible by the blind servant of God. Townspeople of Brule, friends and relatives of those participating in the services, correspondents, and secret servicemen filled the little edifice where the president sat with his eyes fixed on the pastor during the entire ceremony. Most of those in the church now and then stole a glance at the president, who seemed oblivious of their presence. He was alone in his pew near the front, except for attachés, who accompanied him from the Cedar Island Lodge. Mrs. Coolidge, not feeling equal to the trip. Fresh paint and a new roof gave the old structure a very presentable appearance. Inside the church are 13 long wooden pews, and 60 extra chairs were placed in the back to accommodate the unusual attendance. Back of the pulpit is a stained glass window depicting Christ as the shepherd. Before long came a crew of correspondents, photographers, and newsreel men who set up their cameras close to the church. Colonel E.W. Starling, the president's Secret Service attaché, was also early on the ground making arrangements for the president and taking great precautions to any untoward occurrences. Townspeople and visitors gathered, and soon there were some 200 in and outside of the church. At 10:50 a.m., Mr. Golder pulled the bell ropes, which hang down just inside the church door, summoning the record flock to the services. They went in, finding places that had not been reserved for the president or for the host of correspondents. All the church waited for the president's arrival. About 11 o'clock, three cars drew up before the church. President Coolidge stepped out of the one with Colonel Osmond Latrobe and White House physician Colonel James F. Cooper. Mr. Taylor began his sermon with a recognition of the unusual honor the church had received by the president's attendance. He related the words of Christ to the fishermen when he told them to cast their nets to the right of their boat, and they did so, making a big catch. He gave glimpses of Peter and of Nicodemus, and other disciples, quoting him, "We must believe what is given to us," said Mr. Taylor. "Why should we question it? As for the unbelievers, they have no rock of faith to fall back on in life's crises." During the services, the church grew uncomfortably warm, its only ventilation being through two windows on opposite sides of the church, which were held open, one by a hammer, the other by a short stick. Three hymns, "I Love to Tell the Story," "Love Divine," and "Abide with Me," were sung by the congregation. Earl Brayman of Superior played the piano during the musical numbers. The service over, the president rose and stepped out in the aisle to shake hands with Mr. Taylor and Reverend Bayes. He said that he had enjoyed the sermon and the ceremony. As all present arose to leave, President Coolidge took Mr. Taylor by the arm and led him down the aisle, down the new concrete steps, and to the front walk, where the small army of cameramen had pitched their tripods in a phalanx. There the President, Mr. Taylor, and Reverend Bayes stood before the lenses for fully 10 minutes, giving the newsreel men ample opportunity to run off miles of film. Lou?
Airmail service between Superior and Washington is carried daily to the President's office in Superior by Army Airmail Service. Pilots make connections with the regular airmail service between Chicago and Washington at Chicago's field. All construction work on the new hangar at Parkland near Superior was completed Saturday afternoon. The entire building is 152 feet long, taking only 3 days to build. The planes leave Chicago at 5:40 a.m. with the president's mail, covering the 400 miles to Parkland's field in an average of 4 hours. Airmail pilots alternate the flying. KUWS radio news time is 5:09. Jack McKenna has this important message from Piggly Wiggly.
Kind of sounds funny when you say Piggly Wiggly, Lou.
Jack McKenna has this very important message from Piggly Wiggly.
There's no serious way to say Piggly Wiggly.
Oh, well, from Piggly Wiggly, well, really, Piggly Wiggly, owned and operated by a local company. They have firm, ripe bananas, good for the kiddies, 5 cents a pound. Wow. Fancy jumbo cantaloupes, 2 for 23 cents. Silver nut margarine, 2 pounds for just 37 cents. Libby's peaches, 2 big cans, sliced or halves, 49 cents. Oh, boy. America's most famous dessert, Jell-O, 2 packages for 15 cents. Pollyanna flour, every sack guaranteed. 24.5 pounds for $1.15. 49 pounds for $2.19. Soap. Are you feeling a little dirty, folks? Soap. 7 bars. P&G. 3 packages. Celox. All for just 45 cents. How about that, Lewis?
Amelia Earhart has landed on the other side of the Atlantic, just when her gas supply ran out. We have this shortwave report from Wales.
It's a sunny day for a celebration for folks here. While all of England and Ireland waited on tiptoe this morning to welcome this American transatlantic plane, Friendship, from her Atlantic flight, is Amelia Earhart, the first woman to conquer the great ocean by air, and her two companions settled down unexpectedly in Bury Estuary, Wales, shortly after noon today. The transatlantic monoplane landed in Bury Estuary on the Carmarthenshire coast owing to a lack of fuel. The crew looked well when taken ashore by motorboat and did not appear fatigued by the 2,000-mile air journey. Till about noon, it seemed that the Friendship would land at Southampton, which was her goal. That seaport was all set to give the American girl and the plane a great welcome. The first definite report that the Friendship was on this side of the Atlantic came from the steamship America, over which the plane circled twice 70 miles southeast of Cobb. The plane dropped several notes, but these did not land on the steamer. The big question remained as to just where she would set down. The Friendship slipped in over Bristol Channel, which is at the mouth of the River Severn, and came down in Bury Estuary. It was 12:40 in the afternoon, just 20 hours and 43 minutes after Friendship took off from Trespassy, Newfoundland. She had been held 10 days by unfavorable weather and difficulty in taking off with her great load of gasoline. The trimotored ship, the first equipped with pontoons to make the direct crossing, came to rest as the tide was fully out. The pontoons soon drove into the sand close to shore. A launch was sent out immediately to the plane to take the flyers ashore. Not in years has this tiny port experienced such a thrill as when the big plane swooped into the estuary carrying the first woman ever to cross the Atlantic by air. It was doubtful if many people in the little port even knew that the plane was en route. However, it did not take long for news of the great achievement to spread. People quivered with excitement at being in on such a feat. Miss Amelia Earhart combines the calm and determined daring of Colonel Lindbergh with the charm, beauty, and independence of the modern American college girl. She's still on the young side of 30, tall, slender, and wears her light curly hair bobbed close to her head. Since leaving school, she has supported herself as a social worker in the slums of Boston. Miss Earhart, for 2 years, held the women's altitude record of 14,000 feet and has been flying since 1918. Her friends say she is the kind of girl who will not endorse lipsticks, powder puffs, or toothbrushes. She was born in Atkinson, Kansas in 1898. She was graduated from Hyde Park High School in Chicago, attended the Argonne School for Girls in Philadelphia, and served overseas as a nurse during the war. Though she resembles Lindbergh in stature and features, Miss Earhart was much more studious while in school than Lindbergh, where she drew honors for high grades. Lindbergh was dismissed because of his failures. In Barry Estuary, Wales, this is Thomas Lefroy.
This is John Powell in Madison. The University of Wisconsin today conferred on former student Charles Lindbergh the greatest honor it can give, an honorary degree. Lindbergh, national hero since his flight alone over the Atlantic last year, wasn't much of a scholar when he was studying in the state school in 1920 to 1922. So the university authorities, as they do in cases where scholastic attainment are not up to standard, asked him to discontinue his work there. He did. Then he took up flying, having become interested in it while a student. Then he flew the Atlantic. Commencement of 1927 came apace. The university wanted to honor him, but he was tied up in post-flight celebrations and a transcontinental tour last year. Negotiations were open to have him here for the 1928 commencement. The Board of Regents approved a degree for him. Speculation on Lindy's acceptance of the honor from the school that threw him out became one of the greatest news stories in Madison. At the state capitol, this is John Powell reporting.
In other news this evening, two robberies were committed late last night in Poplar and Wentworth, about 20 miles from Superior. The Poplar Post Office in the Peterson Mercantile Company store was robbed of $140 in stamps and $75 in cash. Douglas County Sheriff H.A. Turnbull made an investigation at both places. The robbers entered the store through a rear window. They gained access to the safe by breaking off the dial. No cash was stolen at the Wentworth Farmers Cooperative store, but Sheriff Turnbull reports that 50 pounds of coffee had been taken. Moonshiners are on the run in Douglas County. Superior Evening Telegram reporter Henry Peterson has the news.
Sure do, Lou. Vendors of moonshine whiskey have hid their wares in various places, but State Probation Officer Thomas Black says the prize goes to J.R. Ferguson. He operates Dreamland and hides his shine in loaves of bread. The loaf revealing this method was hollowed out, a pint bottle placed in the bread, and the bread wrapper replaced. The bread was resting in the bread box, but when Officer Black opened the box, he smelled moonshine and not bread, thus discovering the pint bottle. State officers visited all the roadhouses by the pavement along United States Highway No. 53, but only the Dreamland Resort at the end of the pavement and a place operated at Gordon by a man giving the name of Charles Robinson were found to have liquor. State officers raided Dreamland last February when a quantity of alleged moonshine was found. In municipal court this morning, Mr. Ferguson entered a plea of guilty, and his pint in the loaf of bread cost him $203 or 4 months in jail. He paid the fine, Lou.
Henry Peterson with the Superior Evening Telegram. And that, Jack, is the news.
Oh, boy, lots of news today, Lou. Wow. I guess you could probably go for a good stiff loaf of bread about now.
I'd prefer that over the coffee in the employee's lounge. It looks like a brand new 50-pound sack of coffee marked Wentworth Farmers Co-op.
You can't believe what a great deal I got for it. Some guy said he had to get rid of it and let me have it real cheap.
Did he also try to sell you some stamps?
As a matter of fact, he did. How did you know?
Unless the word moonshine pops up, you never listen to my news, do you?
Of course I do. I love Lou Martin's news. Let's check the forecast for this Monday, June 18th, 1928. Cloudy skies tonight and tomorrow with showers. A fresh northeasterly wind off Lake Superior will keep things cool in the 50s. Now it's music from our wax recordings. And here's the Charleston Chasers with vocals by Eva Taylor and Ain't Misbehavin' on the Martin and McKenna Show.
A perfect song for you and the Moonshine Guy.
For certain, the one I love, I'm through with flirting, it's just you I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving, I'm saving my love for you. Like Jackie Horner in the corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kisses are worthwhile waiting for. Believe me, I don't stay out late, don't care to go. I'm home about 8, just me and my radio. Ain't misbehaving, I'm saving my love for you.
Charleston Chasers and Ain't Misbehaving. And did you know Fats Waller wrote that song? Friends, Ross Electric Company says here the Democrats swoop it up in Houston. A real political battle with Smith Ritchie and Reed fighting it out for the nomination. RCA Radiola will bring it to you clearly and dramatically. Every word of it. Stop by Ross Electric for a demonstration of the Radiola. Or come by and just listen. Ross Electric, 1225 Tower Avenue in Superior. Now let's continue with that good music with Duke Ellington and Ring Dem Bells on the Martin and McKenna Show.
Duke Ellington and his orchestra, and Ring Dem Bells.
It's time for Community Editor Harriet Feurig. Good evening, Harriet.
Any of your stories about moonshine, Harriet?
Well, as a matter of fact, the Women's Christian Temperance Union will have a meeting tomorrow afternoon at the 22nd Street Methodist Episcopal Church, and they'll be very happy to hear about Prohibition Officer Black's diligence. The ladies will give reports from the union's committees on work done this year. Mrs. A.D.S. Gillette will speak on child welfare. Mrs. M.J. Rooney will talk about prison reform.
And overcrowding because of prohibition.
Oh, Jack, really? Mrs. W.J. Wybright will speak on legislation and law enforcement.
Better hide that 50-pound bag of coffee, Jack, or you might end up in her report.
Mrs. J.G. King on scientific temperance instruction. And Mrs. W.J. Morgan will give a talk on social morality and purity in literature. It should be an exciting afternoon.
About as exciting as when Jack gets arrested for buying stolen goods.
I know, Joe. I know you're next. I just want to say that women's clubs around America are doing what they can to help people. Here's an item which mentions how Indians of the United States owe their Americanization to the General Federation of Women's Clubs. Penobscot Tribal Princess Watasso of Maine says she's not talking about what some people consider Americanization, that is, to get Indians to shun their culture. Rather, Princess Watasso says women's clubs helped her people gain American citizenship.
Now?
All right, Joe, now. The big exciting news today, besides the wonderful activities of President Coolidge...
I would argue his doings pale in comparison to my feet.
What's wrong with your feet?
I think he means exploit, deed, or stunt.
Stunted feet?
No, man. Go ahead. You go ahead and tell him there, Harriet.
Our own engineer, Joe Gardonio.
That's Joe Weedle Gardonio, if you please. It's my new moniker.
He'll be going up a flagpole right here at the Superior State Normal School, and he'll sit there.
My plan is to do it for a couple of days. Well, not quite as good as Shipwreck Kelly's record of 100 hours on top of the Glen Hotel flagpole in Newport near Cincinnati.
Why on earth would you want to do that?
For the good view?
No, man. Get with it. This is the 20s. This is when we young adults test the limits of machine and human endurance. It's kind of a lucky Lindbergh thing.
Sounds like kind of a dumb thing. And I do believe that's all for you, Harriet.
Yes. Yes, Lewis, thank you. And, Joe, be careful.
Careful? Think I worry about being hurt? I scoff at pain. Fear? I say, harumph. This is a defiant act that elders may shake their heads at.
Or people with plain common sense.
I say, test our limits.
Well, let's test our music, folks. Here's Abe Lyman and the Varsity Drag on the Martin and McKenna Pole Sitting Show.
Here is drag, see how it goes. Down on the heel, up on the toes. That's the way to do the Varsity Drag. It's harder than hot, newer than new, cleaner than me, bluer than blue. Guess there's lots of flaws and waving a flag. Say you can pass many a class, whether you're dumb or wise. If you all answer the call when your professor cries, everybody down on the hill, up on the coast, stay at school, learn how it goes. That's the way to do the Varsity Drag.
Lyman's California Orchestra with the vocals of Phil Neely and Varsity Drag on station KUWS. So, Harriet, what happened to your mutt contest?
Well, nobody showed up. I'm afraid no one wants to admit their dog is a mutt.
My Fluffy is a purebred husky cocker collie poodle.
Case in point.
Sounds like Fluffy's parents had a wild time at the kennel.
He can't be a purebred if he's four different breeds.
That's what the jealous people say.
So, who's this Shipwreck Kelly, anyway?
Shipwreck Kelly is only the king of flagpole sitter-itters, that's who. It is said that through darkness, through rain and snow, through any hazard nature can throw at him, Shipwreck Kelly will not be moved from his flagpole.
Dare I ask why he's called Shipwreck Kelly?
I'm still wondering why Joe calls himself Wheel.
Everyone in the hero business has got to have a snazzy nickname. Mine is Wheedle, as in engineer. You know, to engineer something is to wheedle something.
I wish you'd wheedle the newsroom speakers. They've been broken for 2 weeks.
Background information on such luminaries as Shipwreck Kelly isn't easy to find, as is often the case of us men of mystery. But it is said that he is a native of the Bronx and served 13 years in the Merchant Marines, where he served under the flags of four countries during the war.
And that's when he was shipwrecked?
Nothing quite so pedestrian as that. No siree, our man is special. It is said that he was a crew member of the Titanic.
Oh.
Yeah, impressed, I see. Oh, yeah. Well, pole sitting is actually a revered ancient discipline of stylitism or column sitting. They used to do it in Antioch. In fact, St. Simeon the Elder sat on a column for 36 years.
All right, all right. I've heard enough.
Goes back to the 4th century.
Which makes him really elder. We've got time for one more number, friend. Here's George Olson and Bye Bye Blackbird on the Martin and McKenna Pole Show. George Olson and Bye Bye Blackbird on station KUWS. So, Joe, how are you going to sit on the top of a flagpole anyway?
My burning question is, why?
Well, I got an idea a while back and I tried fin sitting, but ever since I got beat up by Bertha Pertolo, I thought pole sitting sounded a little safer.
But I'm interested in how you do it, too.
By simply placing a small platform on top of the pole. In studying the shipwrecked Kelly writings, his secret is a comfortable, tightly fastened, rubber-covered wooden seat.
There's one other secret nobody's talking about.
For good reason.
Oh, for goodness sakes, Jack, the things you talk about.
Hey, I'm just being practical.
What's that?
How do you go to the bathroom up there? Just yell, look out below?
I amuse myself by reading the paper and my fan mail. I protect myself from the rain with my trusty black duck rain hat. I feed myself with soup and only soup for reasons I think I need not explain. I use that same said bucket for hoisting up the soup and to send down other fluids. By the way, I need some volunteers to help me with that.
I've got to wash my hair.
Don't look at me.
You're going to have to get someone else, Weedle. I'd do it, but, well, Lou, Give me an excuse.
How about you'll be busy getting arrested? Officer Larson is poking around in the radio lounge. He's asking about the 50-pound bag of coffee.
Yikes! Stay tuned for the market reports. Organ music, Roxy and his gang, and little Joe Warner. We'll be back same time, same old place on your radio dial. The good Lord willing. And Officer Larson likes free coffee. For Lou Martin and the gang, this is Jack McKenna wishing you all a good night.
Hope it doesn't get too windy up there, though. I hate windy. I get pole sick real easy.
Pole sick? You've been listening to Radio Superior 1928, an original production by KUWS Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. Radio Superior is produced and written by Mike Simonson. Harriet Fahrig is played by Jennifer Simonson. Other performances by Don Hansen, John Munson, and Eric Olson. All events reported on Radio Superior 1928 are actual accounts from the Superior Evening Telegram. This is your announcer, Mark Snow, speaking. Good night.